It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program in our Teach Me What You Know segment, we'll find out what it takes to get that novel we have in our head written.
First, for the past 2 weeks, the Sochi Olympics have put women's sports in the spotlight. And during NBC's broadcast, these events were featured in prime time. But for lots of viewers, it'll be the last time women's sports are on their radars until another big event comes along, like the Women's World Cup in 2015 or the next Summer Olympic Games.
It's a problem that women's sports leagues in the United States are well aware of and have been dealing with for years. But why don't we watch women's sports, and what are leagues doing to try to get us interested?
We're joined by now Alana Glass. She's an attorney and sports journalist, as well as a contributor to Forbes Sports Money. But her views and opinions expressed here are hers and do not represent Forbes. Alana, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
So, according to a recent piece in the LA Times, women's leagues like National Pro Fast Pitch and National Women's Soccer League, they're financially struggling. Why aren't they getting the support they need?
Well, you know, there's a few pieces to the situation. First, I will say that starting up a sports league, whether it's male or female, that's difficult. You know, if you look at the NBA when it first started, you know, it took time for that league to grow. So in general, it takes a while for a sports league to grow. The second piece to consider is that Title IX, which is the federal law that says that no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in sport for an institution that receives federal financial assistance, that doesn't exist in professional sports. So, you know, any league is basically going to thrive based on the investors that it has. And then thirdly, I would say that really our country needs to restructure its attitudes towards female professional athletes. So I think all of those pieces play into the National Pro Fast Pitch and the National Women's Soccer League struggling at this point.
Well, those are all interesting points, but I want to dig into that last one about how we need to restructure our attitudes about women's sports. What do we need to change about the way we think about them?
Well, you know, one, I think that we definitely need to change the messenger. The Women's Media Center just produced a study that came out, I believe, just last week. And from that study, they show that in sports journalism, it's 90% male and 90% white. And by not having a diverse group of journalists, I think that plays into what we're seeing. And I think that also plays into attitudes that are being developed towards female professional athletes.
So it's not just a women's sports issue and a women in sports issue, it's a media issue.
Yes, I would agree that there are moving pieces to what we are seeing in women's sports. And I think that the media also plays a role in it and fairly covering women's athletes. You know, you mentioned at the top of the show, there are many sports fans who will not hear about winter athletes for another 4 years. However, these athletes compete every season in the X Games and the Dew Tour, and they compete overseas, and they're not just only competing in the Olympics.
Well, let's talk about one of the seeming success stories, the WNBA, Women's National Basketball Association, which has shown some encouraging numbers in the last year. What are they doing right?
Right. Well, I will say one thing, that the WNBA has been very resilient. They've had their struggles. They've had teams fold and teams leave markets. So, number one, they've always stayed true to their brand and who they are. They've never dumbed down the sport. They've never stooped to using sex to sell the sport. So I will say that they've always stayed true to their brand. They've made the WNBA the game's a very family friendly environment where fathers can take their daughters, where families can go and enjoy a professional basketball game. And they're entering their 18th season, and it's remarkable to see their growth.
Now, you mentioned that they never used sex to sell their brand. Is that something that you see other women's sports teams and figures trying to do? I mean, even watching the Sochi Olympics, there were times when it seemed like female athletes were being positioned in sort of a glamour shot instead of, you know, in their athletic arena. Is that a tricky line for women athletes to walk?
It is. It is very tricky. ESPN just produced a documentary that came out last year titled Branded, and I would encourage, you know, listeners to check it out. And, you know, they interviewed Chris Evert, and they interviewed drawing a blank here on some Lolo Jones. They interviewed a variety of Mary Lou Retton, a variety of well-known female athletes, and discussed how America brands women's sports. And you know, unfortunately, athletic achievements are supposed to speak entirely for themselves. But unfortunately, women have an extra layer where value is placed on appearance rather than their accomplishments. And girls get a message early on that what is most important is how they look, and that depends on their value. And boys get the message that this is what's important about girls. You know, so we really need to take a look at what message we're sending to our youth and how this continues to evolve and how it impacts women athletes and how they are seen in the media.
Do we know whether watching women play sports on TV has equal appeal to watching men play sports on TV? When you're watching athletes at the top of their game, top competitors maybe in the world, like we saw in the Olympics, does that seem to be as appealing to both genders?
You know, I think that it is appealing. You know, just as an aside, as I was watching the gold medal women's hockey game, my Twitter feed, everyone was tweeting about it. Male and female, you know, every single goal, the overtime, there was a lot of buzz around around that game. So I do believe that fans equally enjoy women's and men's sports. The challenge is that women's sports only get 4% of coverage, but 40% of sports participants are female. So there is an imbalance in the coverage. And unfortunately, with that imbalance, it makes it look like fans don't actually care. But it, in fact, they do.
We're talking right now with Alana Glass about why women's sports still aren't getting the attention that men's sports get. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Do you watch women's basketball or other women's sports? And do you think these leagues suffer from a lack of exposure? If so, what would you like to be done? What would you like to see be done to change that? 1-800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about why women's sports are still flying under the radar in this country. And you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. What about you? Do you watch women's basketball or other women's sports? Do you think that women's sports suffer from a lack of exposure? Maybe we don't see them enough on TV. And what would you like to see done about it? 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. And we're talking with Alana Glass now, an attorney and sports journalist, contributor to Forbes Sports Money. And we'll go to the phones now. We've got Matt on the line from Middleton. Hi, Matt.
Hello. I just had a quick question, and I'll take my answer off the air. I'm wondering why we still have these, what I would consider, kind of outdated categories. Why aren't women allowed to just compete with men outright in all sports? I'll take the answer off. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Matt. And it's an interesting question. Should we integrate men and women on the same teams?
You know, that is an interesting question. And, you know, that's something that, gosh, you know, I don't know if it's really been really looked into. I will say, though, that the quality of competition that you see women bringing in the WNBA and the LPGA, the WTA, you know, that's phenomenal. And I think that the women who compete in those leagues, you know, should be applauded for their accomplishments and for their, you know, for their skills.
Now, I want to ask about how the women athletes themselves feel. Do you think that for, I guess, younger women, especially coming up, and girls, do you think it's demoralizing to see a woman rise to the top of her field in a sport and still not achieve a fraction of the fame or the pay that a male counterpart might? Is it keeping women out of sports?
Yes. You know, I think that, you know, women in general are very resilient. And also a lot of the women who participate in, say, for example, the WNBA, they know that their career is going to be short-lived, just in general, being able to perform at a high level. So you'll find, you know, a number of women who are very dedicated to academics and completing their college educations. And, you know, not all women athletes are necessarily striving for that, you know, that same level that, that men have to make the millions, millions of dollars. You know, a lot of the women, again, they retire and they go on to be entrepreneurs, or there's women who leave the collegiate ranks and then go into business. So, you know, I don't think that women feel demoralized. It's just another challenge, another hurdle to overcome.
Let's go back to our phone lines now, and you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, wondering why women in sports aren't getting the same attention that men in sports get. And we'll go down to Jeff in McKinley, Illinois. Hi, Jeff.
How are you doing?
Okay, how about you?
Great. No, I just wanted to say that, you know, it's just the way I see things. And I just got done watching all the Olympics. And things like, you know, like gentlemen mentioned before with golf, you know, where things are moved up, you know, because of you don't have the strength or something, whatever the reason that they make it less challenging for women, or the military where they don't have to do as many pull-ups, whatever. It seems like a stigma has been placed on them that whatever sport they play in, it's not as, there's not as much strength, there's not as much power in this. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, you make an interesting point that, yes, in golf, you know, the tee boxes are moved forward. But, you know, there are a number of sports where women go head-to-head on the same competition space. For example, in the X Games, the female snowboarders are on the same half pipe as the men, same for slope style. So you will find that there are, you know, a number of sports where women are competing on the same playing surface as the men. It just so happens, you know, for golf that, you know, the tee boxes move forward.
Now, I want to ask you, going back to the media coverage, you said I think only 4% of women's sports end up on TV. Is that right?
Yes, yes.
Well, so in 2010, ESPN launched ESPNW, a platform that the network says serves women as fans and athletes. And I guess on the one hand, it does provide a place for women to go and for women's sports to air. But on the other hand, is it sort of ghettoizing women's sports? Maybe is it condescending, or is it a good thing?
You know, I actually think that it's a good thing. I had the opportunity to attend the 2013 ESPNW Summit and hear directly from their leadership. The president of ESPN was there, John Skipper, who said, you know, that the purpose of the summit was to really focus their efforts on what they can do to drive women's sports. You know, I think that, unfortunately, ESPN received some unfair criticism for creating ESPNW, that, as you mentioned, you know, fans felt like, oh, it was going to be pink and frilly and, again, kind of dumbed down, but in fact, it's not that. A lot of the journalists who write for ESPNW are phenomenal. They created the 9 for 9 documentary series, and you know, they're really, it was meant to be a place for women who love sports and really to, that speaks to them as athletes and fans.
Alana, as our last question here in our last 30 seconds or so, what are we missing by not watching women's sports?
Wow. You know, you're missing some phenomenal competition. The women who participate in women's sports are extremely dedicated, very talented. I will say that each time I attend an event, I am blown away. And I also think that, remember that women and girls get more out of sport than just the physical benefits. It assists with confidence. And I really think that by having women's participation in sports, you know, can really help to move our country forward.
Alana, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Alana Glass, an attorney and sports journalist, as well as a contributor to Forbes Sports Money.
It's time for Teach Me What You Know. Each week, we take the time to learn how to do something new. Last week, we learned how to respond to a medical emergency with the president of Wisconsin's EMS Association.
This week, we're learning how to write a novel. Tony Vanderwerker had the opportunity to work with John Grisham on his novel Sleeping Dogs, and he writes about that experience and what he learned from Grisham in his book Writing with the Master.
A lot of people have thought about writing novels, but are maybe overwhelmed by where to start or how to find the endurance to get it done. Tony Vanderwerker joins us now to give us some tips. Tony, welcome to the show.
Hi, Veronica and Rob. How are you guys?
Great. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Well, can anyone write a novel?
If you have the imagination and the perseverance and you have this urge to tell stories, I think those are the major qualifications.
Well, a lot of people sense that they just have a book in them, that it's waiting to get out. And you were actually mentored by one of the biggest best-selling authors of our time, John Grisham. He wrote The Firm, he wrote The Pelican Brief, he wrote loads of other books that were incredibly successful. What did he teach you about how to begin a novel?
Well, the first thing John said is, I'm talking about writing thrillers. He said you need an elevator pitch. You don't have a good book idea unless you can express the concept of the book in one sentence. For instance, The Firm, a young lawyer gets a dream job that turns out to be a nightmare. You need it to be that concise, otherwise it's going to get too complicated.
So say you've got that basic sound premise. What's next? Do we do an outline? Is that a good next step?
Well, before you need to do an outline, but I'd rather get to another point first, which is, John makes the point to me that you need to hook the reader in the first 40 pages. I thought that was a bit arbitrary, but I went back and looked at 10 or 12 of his novels, and sure enough, within a 39 to 40 page length, he's hooked the reader. He's created a situation which is unresolvable, and the reader is fascinated to figure out how the main character gets out of it. So that's his second point, is to hook the reader in the first 40 pages.
That's pretty quick. So was that hard for you as you were sitting down to write your novels?
Well, that's where the outlining process comes in, and that's the third aspect of trying to create a thriller. The complicated part of writing a 350-page book isn't the opening and isn't the ending. Those are relatively easy. It's the 300 pages in the middle that are really challenging. So what you do is you craft an outline to ensure that you start with your beginning and you go through the 300 pages to ensure that the 300 pages will hold up and you don't run out of gas at page 225. So an outline makes you create a strong middle which keeps the reader involved. I'm sure you've read books where you get into page 185 and you're going, what, nothing's happening here, you know? And that's the kind of problem that creates inferior novels and loses readers.
My worry would be that I could, you know, do what you're saying and start outlining and then outline a little more and then maybe do some outlining. Well, how do you know when it's time to make the transition? You've got that structure. Now it's time to start writing the words.
When you've got the complete story, I mean, John put me through seven outlines. It took a year to do these seven outlines. And I describe John's teaching method is the Guantanamo Bay Writers Camp.
Because
I spent a year working on outlines before he wrote word one. So you really need to ensure that you have the a complete plot all the way through, totally worked out before you start writing.
And did you see the benefit of that? 7 outlines is a lot of outlines. Did, at the end of the day, when you had done all of those, did you really see what he was talking about?
Yeah, I did, because the plot became fully developed. Everything held together. It was coherent. There were no loose ends. And the superstructure for the novel was created. And I talk about all these things on TonyVanderWalker.com, and there are a lot of articles for people to read, for your listeners to read, where I elaborate on it more. And, of course, writing with a bestseller brings it alive.
You've got the outline in place. I always wonder, from author to author, do you then start at the beginning or after that hook and work from there? Or do you find yourself jumping around? I'm in chapter 9 today. I'm on chapter 2 tomorrow.
Well, here's the interesting thing. I thought when I was finished with the seventh outline, I'd get going. But then John said to me, write a chapter outline. And I said, what? He said, yeah, outline every single chapter so you don't go far afield. You don't get a plot that goes off in a direction that you can't come back to the main plot with. And that was the hardest thing I had to do, was write a chapter outline. But it keeps you honest throughout the book. And so I did that, and I finally started writing. And when you write a thriller, if you're adhering to an outline, going A to B to C, or 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 is the way to do it. You don't want to jump around because you'll end up with holes in the book.
Now, if we aspire to write something other than a thriller or a page-turner, we're aiming for something more literary, something where you can spend a few paragraphs musing about the fragrance of the roses or the flavor of some soup. Do these rules still apply?
No, not entirely. I mean, my feeling about outlines is, if you want to make it hard on yourself to write a book, don't do an outline. If you want to make it easier, do an outline. I mean, it's that simple. And an outline for a literary work, which is character-driven, would have much more to do with the character of the person and how it develops or changes throughout the book, as opposed to a pure plot-driven outline. So you sort of watch your character metamorphosize through the entire book in an outline.
So you've got your outline again in place, and you're writing. How do you keep how do you set your tone and keep a consistent tone in your language selection, in your dialogue?
That's what's called the writer's voice, and you ought to have a writer's voice going into the novel, because if you don't have that consistent kind of attitude coming through on every page, the reader's going to get put off. So writers need to develop their own voice. I mean, every writer has one, and that's what keeps you on tone throughout the whole book.
Tony, how do you know if your idea is good enough to be spending all this time, all this outlining on it, or if it's something, you know, that it will be better left unwritten?
You know, that's a great question. It's probably the essential conundrum of the creative process. No artist ever knows whether what they're doing is right or perfect or going to be appreciated. But you try your hardest and bring all your talents to bear and keep your fingers crossed that you made the right decisions.
One thing that I liked in checking out your book is, I think you refer to it as being something like the continuity director in a movie, making sure you catch those details. What kind of things did you catch yourself, whoops, it's a little glitch in there. I'm glad I caught that.
Well, you got typos, which I call ticks, because they occur everywhere. And you say to yourself, how did that darn thing get there? I looked at this thing 55 times. It's like a tick you get on your head or something. And then there are kinds of detail faults where a character will be drinking a Coke in one room and then they walk into the other room carrying coffee. And the reader goes, well, wait a minute. You know, so you throw the reader right off. Or you get into lengthy exposition about grandma's apple pies that go on for 4 pages. And the reader is going, why am I listening to grandma's apple pies? So you got to be sort of ruthless on yourself and get rid of those wrong expositive passages.
Well, let's say
the mistakes.
Sure. Yeah. Let's say you make it through that novel and that draft and all those outlines, and you get to the end of it. How do you tie it all up? What makes for a satisfying ending?
The ending you should have in your head before you start writing the book. I mean, it's pretty dangerous to be at 300 pages and not know what the ending is. At least from my point of view. I mean, I'm sure Stephen King would have a different point of view, but you really want to get that ending down, and then you want to find your beta readers, your best friends, people whose judgment you rely on the most, and give that second or third draft to them and say, hey guys, give me an honest read on this. And then that's when you start to be able to really revise and improve the work.
Tony, you had a bunch of unfinished projects before you started working with John Grisham. You worked with him, you did the outlines, you finished a book. What did it feel like when you finally could say, I finished a novel?
It was very rewarding, but the downside was I submitted it into an atmosphere in New York where people were tired of those kinds of books, and I couldn't sell it. So I parked it in a drawer and then wrote Writing with a Master about writing with John, went back and revised it, and 4 years later the market was different and it got picked up along with Writing with a Master. So having two books published after having seven novels rejected is wonderful.
It's got to be a good feeling. And, you know, in our last 30 seconds, any advice about how to get it published or how to publish it, since there are different options today?
Well, there's a self-publishing option, which is viable, and it's easier and easier to do. The problem with that is that you're going into a sea of manuscripts, and you need to find a way to get discoverability. You need to find a way to get people to notice your work. And that's a huge challenge. It always requires some investment of time and or money. And the regular traditional publishing route is still an option, and people should keep trying that. Keep submitting to agents. Get your work as good as you can possibly get it, as perfect as you can get it. Because if you don't get it that way, people will reject you right out of hand. And then start submitting it.
Well, Tony, lots of good advice there to take you up on. Thank you so much for sharing your advice and what you learned from John Grisham.
Enjoy talking to you guys. Bye-bye.
We've been speaking with Tony Vanderwerker about how to write a novel for this week's installment of Teach Me What You Know.